Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Why write a primer about global affairs, and what might the impact of that knowledge be for our new generation? Richard Haass will join us to talk about his book, The World. How does a critic approach fiction in translation? Abhijyoti Chakraborty will be here to talk about new fiction from Japan, Cuba, Palestine, and France. Alexander Alter will have an update from the publishing world. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's June 26th. I'm Pamela Paul. Richard Haass joins us now. He is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, the author of 14 books. His newest book is called The World, A Brief Introduction. Richard, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Pamela.
So I have to say up front, we are recording this podcast on June 18th, and I'm sorry to bring up another book, but I'm going to because it's so much in the news. Yesterday, John Bolton's forthcoming book, The Room Where It Happened, leaked to the press, and a lot of it was reported widely. I don't know if you've seen the book itself, but I'm sure that you saw what got out there. I'm curious to hear your reaction.
Well, I've not read the book. I've seen all the news reports. My basic reaction is, if all that, what he reports is true, it's not clear to me why he remained where he was as long as he did. It's not at all clear why he saved it for the book rather than testified at a critical moment in the country's history. So he comes off to me as something of an enabler and then an opportunist. But on the policy side, it fills in a lot of what many people speculated about a president who is obsessed with his own political prospects and whose grasp of foreign policy, shall we say, is modest.
In terms of foreign policy specifically, because that's your area of expertise, what surprised you the most, or what did you find the most revelatory in terms of the things that came out or have come out thus far?
One is simply a lack of basic familiarity with facts, with what he inherited. Inappropriateness vis-a-vis foreign leaders, the idea of encouraging a degree of involvement in our politics. What didn't come out in the public report so much, actually with one exception, which was the threat to leave NATO, it reinforces the sense that Mr. Trump is a radical departure. Every American president from Harry Truman through Barack Obama, whatever their differences, had a lot in common. And Donald Trump is the first person to be in the Oval Office as president who did not share and does not share many of the basic assumptions about this country's role in the world. And he was willing to throw it overboard, to talk about leaving NATO, to enter into fundamentally different relations with America's foes. And it's just a stark reminder of just how different he is from every other person who has held that job.
Well, while we're on that point, there was, of course, a lot of talk after he gave his commencement speech to the graduating class at West Point this year. And one of the comments I saw, I think it was in an article, an op-ed perhaps online, remarked that U.S. foreign policy has really fundamentally gone from helping other nations and sort of lifting them up and moving them towards democracy to defending against our enemies. Does that analysis ring true to you?
Not quite. At any point in American foreign policy, there's always a tension between realism and ideals. And promotion of democracy or human rights have been an aspect of foreign policy, essentially, until this administration, but rarely have been dominant. And I think for a lot of the Cold War, for example, we were willing to get awfully close to a lot of unsavory regimes simply because they were anti-communist. No, what's different about Donald Trump is not that. it is that he sees the costs of American foreign policy almost exclusively, doesn't seem sensitive or in recognition of any of the benefits. So he's as close as we've had to an isolationist, certainly is the most unilateralist president we've had, sees trade agreements as rigged against us. These are deeply held views. He came into the job. I know this because we met once during the campaign. He came into the job sincerely believing that that allies were there to take advantage of us, and that the United States, whatever we derive from our involvement in the world, was overwhelmed by the economic costs of it.
What were the circumstances of your meeting with him?
He was at that time running for president, and we knew each other from the world of golf. I think more important, he would see me on Morning Joe, because that was the phase where he was on that show quite a lot. And he asked to get together with me to talk about foreign policy. And we spent an hour in his office at Trump Tower. And I would just say that I can't discern any impact I had.
What did you most want to convey to him?
What I most wanted to convey to him was to make sure he understood what he was inheriting, and that for 70 years, since the end of World War II, we have had an extraordinary run of history. If you think about it, compared, say, to the first half of the 20th century, we've avoided great power wars. The Cold War stayed cold. We've seen extraordinary improvements in living standards in the United States and around the world. We've seen extraordinary improvements, ironic because we're talking in a pandemic, in longevity of life around the world. All sorts of diseases have been eradicated. This is, you know, we've seen democracy much increase its footprint in the world. This has been an extraordinary era. You could almost call it a golden age in global history. I'm not saying things haven't gone wrong. I'm not saying we didn't make mistakes in Vietnam and Iraq and so forth. But by and large, it has been an extraordinary run, totally affordable. We've been able, if you will, to have our cake and eat it. We've been active in the world, but things have improved at home. And I'd wanted him to gain an appreciation of what he was walking into. And needless to say, I did not succeed.
All right. I want to talk to you about some of the most recent developments in American history and international history, two of which have taken place after you finished writing your book, The World, A Brief Introduction. And to be upfront, those two obvious things are the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement. And of course, the one that occurred while you were writing this book, or presumably before, during, was the 2016 election of Donald Trump and the shift that resulted in the United States' relationship with the rest of the world. But I want to start first with your day job, running the Council on Foreign Relations, because it's an organization, if you're not in it or you're not familiar with what it does, it sounds very mysterious. I don't know that many people understand exactly what the council does, what its purpose is, what its history is, and its mission.
Well, thank you for asking. It is my day job. The council was created in this country 99 years ago. 2021 will be our 100th anniversary. It was created really amidst the debate about what the United States would do in the world after World War I, amidst the whole debate about the League of Nations. And it was founded by a bunch of businessmen and lawyers, essentially in the Northeast. And the whole idea was to have a constant conversation, they called it conference, about this country's relationship with the world. The implicit bias was against isolationism. There was a bias in favor of joining the new League of Nations. Needless to say, they failed. The United States did not join the League. Isolationism and protectionism were rampant until World War II. And what the Council has been over this century is many things. We're a membership organization. We're now 5,000 members scattered around the United States. We're a publisher. We've got several websites, CFR.org. We publish Foreign Affairs magazine. We're a think tank. We have maybe 75, 80 scholars working on every aspect of international relations. We do all sorts of meetings. I like to say we meet more than any organization, with the possible exception of the European Union. We are an educator. We are now in the process of producing all sorts of educational materials for use in college and high school classrooms, and also beyond the classroom. And we're a resource. We're nonpartisan. We don't subscribe to either party. We don't take any support from the U.S. or any other government, so we're independent. And we're meant to be a resource for members, but also for non-members, for religious leaders, for mayors, for governors, for students, for teachers, you name it, to help them better understand the world and better understand foreign policy choices.
Your new book is called The World, A Brief Introduction, and it feels like, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is a book where you are almost trying to do what the Council on Foreign Relations does for beginners, in a way, for people who don't understand why all of this is so important. Was that the intention that you had writing this book, or what was your goal?
It is a primer, or what the Brits would call a primer. It's meant to be a foundational book to give people the background they need to make sense of all the news. It could be a student's first book in high school or college. It could be a 70-year-old's read. I don't assume anything in terms of prior knowledge. I try to unpack everything to explain it. I try to avoid either too much or too little. So it's educational, not in the classroom sense, but it's an attempt, yes, to be educational in the larger sense of the word.
And what was the impetus for writing it?
There's a couple of things. One is I was one day fishing off of Nantucket, and I met this young man about to go into a senior year at Stanford, and he was majoring in computer sciences. And I was stunned after a series of questions and answers that he was going to graduate from one of the world's greatest universities and would essentially leave campus without any knowledge of this world he was going to enter that was going to affect his life. He wasn't where he needed to be an informed citizen. And when I went back to my office in New York, I looked at it, and it turned out that that was true not just of Stanford, but of virtually every college and university in the United States, that these courses were offered in most cases, but they weren't required. You could navigate your requirements and essentially leave campus illiterate about the world, and all this at a time, and as we're living through now, all this at a time where the world has such a fundamental role to play in our lives, whether it's pandemics, or as we learned on 9/11, terrorists, or whether it's climate change, or you know, virtually any other manifestation of living in a global world of nearly 8 billion people. And I was simply struck by the gap between the objective importance of the world and how little many Americans, and not just Americans, but how little many Americans knew about it. And so what my goal was to make them more informed. And the more I looked at it, there wasn't a book that did it. Most of the textbooks in the field, they're written as if they were written to discourage people from reading a second book. They're heavy, heavy on theory that, from what I can tell, bears little or no relationship to the real world. So I wanted to write a book that was interesting, that was useful, that was accessible. People will have to judge whether I succeeded, but that was the plan.
I want to stay on that point about Stanford and about university education for a moment, because the CFR, as you mentioned earlier, is involved in education as part of its mission. Why is it? How is it that you can graduate from school not having a kind of basic knowledge of world history and global affairs? Is it that we don't require, universities no longer require sort of big survey courses? Is it that people home in on micro history or narrow subjects without getting a broader view?
The short answer is yes. I think universities are loath to say, to declare themselves and say, this is what you need to be an educated person. Because one could argue that you would want to have people not just have skills like critical thinking and writing and speaking and the rest, but you would want them, for example, to know about American democracy. Why should we assume the DNA of our democratic process and values automatically gets transmitted from one generation to the next? I don't think it does. But yet, you can graduate from virtually any campus and not have taken anything that in my generation was called civics. Same thing about the world. I think universities are reluctant to make that judgment that this is what it is we believe you need. And there's we live in an age where everyone feels that they're in a best position to define what it is they want. It's kind of a la carteism. And my argument is we ought to deliver a fixed pre-menu. And if you don't like it at our school, fine. Maybe we're not for you. There's a lot of other schools which will offer up their view of what a modern education needs to be. But from what I can see, universities are extraordinarily reluctant to do that.
I mean, you would think that even if kids, college-age students, didn't learn this as part of their education, you would think that in the internet era, in an age of globalization, that young people in particular would have great knowledge about the world out there. They have so much access, whether it's going onto Google Earth or onto social media, to immediately be in touch with any corner of the world. how is it possible that even if they're not getting it in their education, that young people aren't gleaning this information, this sort of global awareness in the rest of their lives, or global literacy, as you call it?
The answer is they have both too much and too little access, or it's unsystematic. Sure, you can find anything on the internet, but you can also drown there. Or you can find yourself on websites that have had no editing. There's no gatekeepers. So how is somebody supposed to get a balanced, comprehensive, fact-checked take on something? And the answer is you can't assume it. You certainly won't get it watching the nightly news on the networks. The majority of places on the internet, you're not going to get it. People might be interested, say, in climate change on America's campuses. There's a lot of interest there, but there's not a lot of interest in most history. There's not a lot of interest, say, on what's going on with proliferation or terrorism or European security, or to understand Russia or necessarily Japan. There might be some interest in China, but not in Venezuela. Access to information is to me not a substitute, because there's nothing about it, again, that's systematic, that shows you how everything relates. So it's a little bit like touching the ear of the elephant. You might learn a lot about the ear, but you're not going to get a comprehensive or realistic or accurate view of the elephant.
Earlier, you were talking about how there are a number of things, a number of measures by which it looks like the world is getting in better and better shape, current pandemic excluded. And your previous book, though, was called A World in Disarray, which does not sound very optimistic. And I'm curious, on the spectrum of optimism to pessimism, with, say, Steven Pinker over on the optimism side, and I don't know, everyone else maybe on the pessimism side, where do you fall, and how is that reflected in this book?
I am on the pessimistic side. I disagree with Steven Pinker and others, and I, quite honestly, at the risk of being harsh, I think he and others cherry pick what data they use to make their point. So they point out, for example, that there's less war between and among countries. That's true, but there's more conflict within countries. And I see the potential for war between and among countries going up. But I'm definitely on the pessimistic side. I think history pulls you in that direction. I also don't think that good things just happen. And when I look at the trends, when I look at things like the revival of great power competition, when I look at the growing gap between these various global challenges like climate change and the global response, when I look at the fact that more than what now one out of every 100 people in the world is either internally displaced or a refugee, and above all, when I look at the reality that the United States, which has been the architect and the general contractor of international order for the last 75 years, is now pulling back from the world, is abdicating, and I don't see anybody else willing and able to take our place, I am increasingly concerned about the trends. And I think what's going on in our country recently, Pamela, will exacerbate that. I believe and fear we are in for a serious phase of turning inward. We've got to deal with the pandemic. We've got to deal with tens of millions of unemployed. We've got to deal with racism. We've got to deal with protest and so forth. And I think this will lead Americans to say, we don't have the luxury right now. We don't have the bandwidth to cope with the world. We've got to fix our internal problems. We've got to address them. And my reaction is, yes, we do have to fix what's wrong here. God knows. The world's not going to give us a timeout. History, I like to say, doesn't have a pause button. So we've got to do both. But my concern is we're not going to have the appetite to do both. And we're going to turn inward just at a time that there's an argument we actually need to be more, not less involved in the world.
Do you agree fundamentally, and if not, point out where you differ, with arguments made by people like George Packer, who in The Atlantic recently talked about the current pandemic as really making clear, even more clear, fundamental problems that were already here in this country? Or has this made them worse?
I think the problems were there beforehand. Anyone landing at an American airport would notice the poverty of our infrastructure. What, 30-odd thousand or more Americans a year die from guns? More Americans die every year from opioids than died in the Vietnam War. K through 12 education is simply, I think, often scandalous in this country. I could go on and on, but I think even something like healthcare, we spent, nearly twice what the average developed country spends on healthcare. But the last I checked, we're not twice as healthy and we don't live twice as long. So there's many things that are wrong in this country. George, in his article, went farther than I would have gone. But I think the idea that there is something wrong here at home, I think that's true. we've got to fix it both for in and of itself. We need to do that. But also it's important for our national security. We're not going to set an example others want to emulate if we're seen as deeply flawed. We're not going to be competitive. We're not going to have the resources. We're not going to be able to focus on the world if we face massive problems here at home. And the whole lesson of this pandemic and the whole lesson of 9/11 is we can't ignore the world. Or if we do ignore the world, it's at our peril. These oceans that surround us are not moats. We've got to pay attention to the world and we've got to fix things here at home. By the way, the good news is we can afford to. If you look at everything we're now spending on defense, as a percentage of our economy, as a percentage of our gross national product, it's actually only about half what we averaged during the Cold War. And the last I checked, during the 50s and 60s, we did okay here at home. So the message I take is we can do both. We should do both. The challenge for a president and for other leaders is to make that case to the American people.
Okay, speaking of big problems here and abroad, the most recent big news story in this country, of course, has been around race and racism and the current mm-hmm. protests, the Black Lives Matter movement. In your most recent weekly CFR update, you wrote, "The movement for racial equality and police reform has a profound impact on the standing of the United States and the world." Of course, the civil rights movement had a similar effect during the Cold War and the Vietnam War specifically. Since your book is really a history and a look at how history infuses our current global affairs, but you wrote it before this most recent development. What kind of parallels do you see between the civil rights movement, earlier cases in which our own race and racism problems here in America have rippled out to the world?
I actually think they have multiple effects, but what's really in common is that, to use an expression we used during the 60s, the whole world is watching. You know, McLuhan's idea of the global village. So what happens here doesn't stay here. If things that begin in Wuhan come to the United States, things that happen in the United States travel to the rest of the world. And something like civil rights or the recent protests, on one hand, it shows friction. In some cases, it shows terrible violence, police brutality, which obviously communicates a terrible image. On the other hand, if political protest is largely peaceful and it leads to significant change, then I think it sends a wonderful, powerful message of a dynamic democracy that's able to accept and channel protest into needed political reform. And the civil rights movement in the 60s in particular did exactly that. So, you know, I think it tends to cut both ways. And what matters now is really what comes of this. Ultimately, protest can't be an end in itself. It's got to be channeled, I would say, into political reform, whether it's reform of policing or other institutions. Hopefully, a lot of people will register and they will vote. But I think all things being equal, in recent months, the United States has hurt itself more through the pandemic, what's seen as a largely inept performance. I can't imagine, Pamela, that any leader in the world would get up in the morning and say to his government or his people, "I want to emulate the United States and handle this just the way they are." Inconceivable to me. So I think we've taken a major hit from that. These protests, we'll see. I think the jury is out on that. And if, again, this leads to significant reform, then I think that could have a powerful effect on the rest of the world, particularly on countries where peaceful protest is not allowed.
So this is a kind of tough question, I think, for anyone leading any organization, any of those institutions that you were talking about, which is, how does Black Lives Matter and this movement towards greater representation affect an organization like the Council on Foreign Relations? Do you find yourself and your membership looking inward and thinking, okay, what do we do here?
Absolutely, in several ways. One is our membership. As I said before, we have 5,000 members around the United States, and we're looking at our statistics and our trends, and the answer is we're doing better than we did, but we're still not doing good enough, so we will double down there. I think the biggest issue in the field, and it's one we can do something about, is that there's very little representation in this field of foreign policy, international relations, what have you, of minorities. The best thing I think we can do there, and I'm committed to doing it, is to create a pipeline. So we're spending a lot of time with internships, with research assistants. We're spending a lot of time at the historically Black colleges. We do an annual diversity conference. What we're trying to do is get more and more young people of color, and also women, also Hispanics, you name it, to basically see just how interesting and just how important this can be as a career path. So that won't give us instant change, but that's the sort of change over time where we can make a real, I think we can make a real difference. So I am committed to doing that in as many ways as we can. We've obviously got to look at our own hiring and staffing issues, and we can and should do better there. But I actually think one of the important missions of the Council on Foreign Relations is to be a developer of talent, is to be across the board. It's one of the things I'm increasingly interested in. And I think over time, we can make a real difference. So, and you'll see it then in 10 years or 15 years in academic departments, in the State Department or elsewhere in the U.S. government bureaucracy, in NGOs around the world. I really want to introduce to a lot of young people around the country who normally might not come into contact with this. I want them to see that this is a career that they ought to give serious thought to.
All right. One final question. It's also off the news. And I think that it would probably have been front page news if it hadn't sort of happened in the midst of multiple crises, which was the decision. I think it was Angela Merkel who first said, I'm not going to come to Washington for the G7. And there were a number of reasons why. And I don't think she was not the only global leader who hesitated to come here, not necessarily because of the pandemic, but because of a reluctance to align with the United States. When you read that news, what was your reaction?
To me, it was just another sign of how much our alliances have been allowed to deteriorate. She obviously didn't want to get part of a photo op. She has no enthusiasm for Donald Trump. I think she's made the strategic decision that for so long as he is president, she is going to devote the bulk of her calories to Europe, to working in particular with Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, to essentially revive the European project, the European Union. And I think they may well succeed at it. But to me, it's depressing. It was, though, a sign again of how our alliances have been really hurt by this administration. And what's so tragic about that is there's virtually nothing in the world the United States can do better by itself than it can do with others. Multilateralism, to me, is a necessity if you're dealing with global issues. One of the great advantages of the United States is we have this large pool of partners, our allies in Europe, our allies in Asia, like Japan, like South Korea, like Australia. So to throw away these alliances, to see them in transactional terms, or worse yet, as some kind of a foe, is to give up the great structural advantage of American foreign policy. China doesn't have allies. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union didn't have real allies. It had countries that had no choice. We get up every day and we have real allies who can work with us on dealing with this or that regional or this or that global challenge. Say, if we want to reform the global health system to make the World Health Organization better or to produce another organization, well, where else would we go? We'd go to our allies in Europe and in Asia and we'd say, hey, let's work together to do that. So when I see one of our principal allies essentially say, it's not worth it to me to come over here, that's a really sad commentary on the state of American foreign policy.
That's leaving on a down note, but on a positive note, people can certainly start by reading The World, A Brief Introduction, to understand why this matters and why they should care. Richard, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Pamela.
Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He is the author of 14 books, and his newest book is called The World, A Brief Introduction.
Tumi has a soft side. Discover their new Azra bag collection and its pillowy pleats, satin finish, and crescent shape. Azra is the bag to carry for your 9-to-5 and your 5-to-9 plans that follow. Versatility, after all, is Tumi's signature. Shop the full Azra collection on Tumi.com or at a Tumi store near you.
My name is Thomas Gibbonseff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So here's a request for our listeners. I get lots of feedback from you, some complaints, lots of kind words. Really appreciate it. You can always reach me directly at books@nytimes.com. I will write back. But you can also, if you feel moved to do so, review us on any platform where you download the podcast, whether that's iTunes or Stitcher or Google Play or somewhere else. Please feel free to review us and, of course, email us at any time. Abhijyoti Chakraborty joins us now from New Delhi. Avro, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Avro, you reviewed 4 books in translation for us this week. I'm going to run down the titles, and then we'll talk a little bit about the group of books and about the books individually. The books you reviewed for us were Tokyo Ueno Station by Yu Miri, translated by Morgan Giles; The Fallen by Carlos Manuel Alvarez, translated by Frank Nguyen; Minor Detail by Adriana Shibley, translated by Elizabeth Jacquette; and Tropic of Violence by Natasha Apana, translated by Jeffrey Straken. I'm sure that I've mispronounced some of those, which brings me to my first question about translation. What are the challenges of reviewing translated literature when things are written in a language that you may not speak or have read before yourself?
Different critics have different guidelines that they live by with this, but the one I adhere to, at least with the languages I don't know, is that the English should be, I guess, colloquial and not really interrupting the flow of the narrative. That's really integral to me. Apart from that, one tries to suss out what's really the motive of the writer writing in the original language. This usually takes about a couple of readings and then to align oneself with how much the translation is sort of working towards that, or is it hindering the writer's motive as far as you can suss out?
I think people make the assumption that you would have to know the language of origin in order to write about the translation itself. I don't know if you've read translated work in a language other than English that you do speak. Do you feel like you're at an advantage when you do speak both languages?
You do, but then when you read, it's really a translated book is really a different book in a certain sense. English has a different idiom, and things that say work in the original language, say I can speak a couple of other languages apart from English. You can't really expect those things always to work in English. So a translation has to work separately in its own way.
Let's start with the first book, Tokyo Ueno Station by Yu Miri, translated by Morgan Giles. This book is a kind of ghost story. Is that right?
I'm glad we're starting with this. This was one of my favorite books of the 4. And it's narrated by a ghost named Kazuo, I guess. And he used to be a construction worker in Japan. He's worked in Tokyo. He's worked in parts of rural Japan. But the essential point being, all his life he has lived away from home. But towards the end of his life, he ends up in a place. It's a very special place in Tokyo called Tokyo Uno Park. And he sort of ends up there in a homeless camp. The entire novel is told in this retrospective voice of how Kazuo came to end up in this homeless camp.
You describe it as modernist. In what sense is the novel modernist?
Well, it's modernist in the sense that it's narrated in a very experimental way. Kazuo isn't always just speaking about his stories or confessing his feelings. It's interspersed with, say, conversations he might be overhearing from people around the park, be it visitors or his fellow homeless dwellers. He's a ghost, so sometimes he will just disappear into one of the nearby museums and, you'll have pages of descriptions of paintings or what's really happening inside galleries, interspersed with Kazuo's observations of visitors coming there and what he really sees or what he really remembers. Then one of the best parts that keeps recurring is sometimes you have these train announcements that we sort of hear on subway stops, always recurring. And these are motifs that you sort of, as you read the novel, you see sort of how it's all related to Kazuo's story. And I guess that's the part I really found modernist.
All right, let's talk about the next book in the group you reviewed. It's called The Fallen by Carlos Manuel Alvarez, translated by Frank Nguyen. This is a novel that takes place in Castro's Cuba. What's the story?
It takes place in Castro's Cuba. It's really the story of a family. It's a story of a family in Cuba during the Castro years. It's four people in the family. You have the father, Armando, who is sort of an idealist, a fervent socialist, who really believes in his image of himself as honest and irreproachable, and can't really fathom the fact that corruption has sort of become integral to public life in many parts of Cuba. Then you have his wife, Mariana, who used to be a teacher, but has been having regular epileptic attacks. And so she's homebound now. And then there is the younger son who is away doing his compulsory military service. And the family's psychological as well as financial burden falls on their daughter, the older child. His name is Maria. Maria works in a hotel as a waitress. The hotel itself is state-owned, and things really get tricky for her because her father sort of is also posted by the state to be a manager in the same hotel. And the story sort of goes from there.
This was a book in your review where you noted that the translation felt awkward. In what ways?
There were a lot of negative contractions. I think the translator's name is Frank Nguyen. You would have, you know, sentences like, I ask why he does not send and stuff like that. It just made the prose uneven at times. I said it was awkward also in reference to the points of view of the mother as well as the father. And this might also be a corollary to how the book was written in the original Spanish, which is to say that I feel the points of view of the daughter as well as the son, the younger generation's point of view, is very well rendered. You can sort of see how they're sort of frustrated by their parents' generation's idealism and stuff. But with the parents' voices, although they presume to be speaking in their own voices, you always sort of feel like they're being seen from the child's point of view. You never really feel that it's the parents are speaking for themselves.
All right, speaking of multiple narrators, Minor Detail by Adania Shibley, translated by Elizabeth Jacquette. This takes two different stories, two different time periods. What are these stories and how do they connect?
Well, the first story is the story of a Palestinian girl. The story is set in 1949. It's a Palestinian girl is, first captured by a platoon of Israeli soldiers near the border with Egypt. And she's gang raped. She is murdered. That's the story, the first story it's told. But the story is seen as unfolding from the Israeli platoon commander's point of view. And the second story is the story of a Palestinian woman living sometime in the present century, in Ramallah in the West Bank. And she hears about the story reported by an Israeli journalist. It's a commonplace story for her, as she says it, but she's transfixed by this minor detail, which is that the crime was committed exactly 25 years to the day before she was born. And this brings up a sort of strange curiosity in her. Because she lives in Ramallah, in present-day West Bank, her access to Israel is sort of restricted, always mediated, and she can't really cross borders freely, as many of us can. But she borrows a friend's ID, takes a rented car in someone else's name, and crosses into the border to just find out more about the girl.
This sounds like a very tough subject matter to read about. How is it handled by the author, by Shibley?
I think it's handled very subtly, very delicately. You can read the story in multiple ways. I really appreciated that aspect. There are details that are sort of similar. Certain things that you see in the first story sort of reappear in the second story. So in a sense, you can see how life has changed as well as not changed in that part of the world. But at the same time, there is also a way in which, because after you've read both the stories, knowing that the woman from Ramallah in the present day is sort of on a quest to recover the story of the Palestinian girl, you can sort of also read retrospectively the first story as her reconstructed version of what might have happened.
What does the title Minor Detail refer to?
Minor Detail, in a sense, refers very literally it refers to the detail or the coincidence, that the crime was committed exactly 25 years to the day before the woman from Ramallah was born. But it also refers to the details that show up in both stories. In one story, it's haunted with a certain significance. Like you have the smell of gasoline, which in the second story is really commonplace. But in the first story, it's the smell that the Israeli commander associates with the Palestinian girl. He never really sees her as a human being. She's constantly dehumanized. So you see these details, how they become parallel. And of course, when the girl was found originally by the soldiers in 1949, she'd been found with a dog. And there's this whole crescendo of dogs always howling in the desert in the first story, which sort of again recurs in the second story. But in the first story, it always signifies something ominous. But in the second story, it's just the background sound.
Avro, we did not give you very cheerful books to review, I'm afraid. The fourth book is called Tropic of Violence by Natasha Apana, translated by Jeffrey Strachan. This novel takes place on the island of Mayotte, which most people are probably not familiar with. Where is it, and what is the island like as portrayed in this novel?
Even I wasn't aware of Mayotte before reading this book. I guess Mayotte is an overseas French island in the Indian Ocean, northwest of Madagascar, I believe. And it's part of the Comoro Islands, but the only difference being, while the Comoro Islands declared their independence in the 1970s, Mayotte chose to remain on overseas French territory. So what cut to the present day, what that means is you have immigrants escaping desperate conditions in the neighboring Comoro Islands showing up in what they consider France in search of a better life, at least for their children, if not for themselves. So this is the background in which you have a boy named Mose, who's 14 years old. He stays with his adopted white single mother in Mayotte. And Mose's birth mother had similarly come in one night to the island from the neighboring Comoro Islands, and his adoptive mother happened to be the nurse then. So anyway, cut to the present, he's brought up by his adoptive white mother named Marie. But at 14, she one day just drops down dead at breakfast. And the whole novel is sort of unfolds with what happens after that. And his only badge of difference is that French identity card that belongs to his mother, which in a sense distinguishes him now from the other undocumented immigrants coming to the island.
This book didn't quite work for you. Why not?
I should say that after this point, really, what really happens is that you know, every Mose ends up in a teenage gang, and the gangs, they sort of do everything that you tend to expect teenage gangs to be doing, in fact, worse. The entire novel is narrated by voices from the grave. There are sections spoken by his mother, sections spoken by other people who eventually end up dead in the novel. But what really bothered me about the novel was there is constantly a sort of predatory gaze on Mose. So every time he's in a scene, whether narrated by himself or any other character, you always know that something really bad is going to happen, and it tends to always do.
So it sounds very heavy-handed.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's heavy-handed in a way it didn't need to be, because Mose's predicament, Mose's whole dilemma, speaks for itself. What I liked in the novel were those sections where you just see Mose, in a sense, just taking stock of himself or just being himself. You just didn't need to pile up, I felt, so much of crime or so much of, you know, horrific things happening to a teenager to sort of put across the point of how bad life can be in this situation.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you about yourself just briefly before we go, because I believe you are our first podcast guest during quarantine to join us from New Delhi. And I'm curious what the situation is like there now, or at least for you, the extent to which people are quarantined, observing quarantine. What's it like?
Well, I mean, India has sort of reached, at least in New Delhi, where I live, we are sort of approaching the peak of the pandemic. And so this is really a tricky time in a way. I'm guessing New Yorkers must have gone through sometime a couple of months ago. The lockdown used to be harsher in the months of March and April, but right now I guess things have been opened up while cases are sort of increasing. So it's really a tricky time trying to figure out whether how far you can go or how far you can negotiate your own safety and, you know, trying to stay sane as well at the same time.
Well, I'm grateful that you were able to take the time out to join us on the podcast this week. I'm going to run quickly down the titles again for our listeners. The books that you reviewed were Tokyo Ueno Station by Yu Miri, translated by Morgan Giles, The Fallen by Carlos Manuel Alvarez, translated by Frank Nguyen, Minor Detail by Adania Shibley, translated by Elizabeth Jacquette, and Tropic of Violence by Natasha Apana, translated by Jeffrey Strachan. Avro, thank you so much for being here and for reviewing these books.
Thanks for having me.
Abhrajyoti Chakraborty reviews 4 books in translation this week in the book review. Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news in the publishing world. Hey, Alexandra.
Hey, Pamela.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you doing?
I am okay. I'm in my closet.
Same here.
It is air-conditioned in here, which is vital. What's going on with the book business right now?
So this has been a fascinating time in publishing. The last couple of weeks, we've seen kind of an epic clash building between the Trump administration and the Trump family and one publisher in particular, Simon & Schuster. This has happened several times during the course of this administration. The Trump administration has threatened lawsuits against various publishers for producing tell-alls or books that contain damaging information about the president. Most memorably, it was Henry Holt when they published Fire and Fury by Michael Wolff. When they got a cease and desist letter from the president's personal lawyer, they decided to put the book on sale early. It sold incredibly well. So the latest is Simon & Schuster, of course, released John Bolton's book this week. And that was something the Trump administration tried very hard to prevent from happening. They told him he had failed to go through the necessary steps to get security clearances and remove classified information. And they finally asked a judge to prevent his publisher, Simon & Schuster, from distributing the book. The judge denied that, although John Bolton himself may eventually have to forfeit some of his profits, which were substantial. He reportedly got a $2 million book deal. So that clash was playing out just in recent days, and the book just went on sale. I think they've distributed 200,000 copies, according to some of the legal filings. And at the same time, Simon & Schuster is preparing to publish a very explosive, potentially explosive, I should say, I haven't read it, book by President Trump's niece, Mary Trump. And just this week, President Trump's family sought a temporary restraining order to try to block publication of that book by Mary Trump, which is called Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. So the title suggests that this is not going to be a positive book. It's scheduled to be released by Simon & Schuster on July 28th. The book is finished, it's edited, but they're starting this process earlier. I think with the Bolton book, they came in pretty late in the game with the effort to prevent distribution. The books had already shipped. Retailers had them. News organizations had them. All the information started leaking out a few days before publication. So the effort to kind of contain the damage came pretty late, and it was pretty toothless as far as preventing the information from getting out. So in this case, they have a little more leeway. But again, I think the legal precedent is it's very, very hard to preemptively prevent information from coming out. So it's going to be another tough battle for them.
This has been a really eventful year for Simon & Schuster. I mean, first they were put on sale, right? And then very suddenly their chief executive officer, Carolyn Reedy, died of a heart attack. And all of these incredibly explosive books are coming out. Is the company doing well?
At a time when a lot of publishers are struggling to break through the news cycle, Simon & Schuster is creating the news cycle. So that's kind of extraordinary. You know, the John Bolton book has been number one on Amazon for a while. Mary Trump is close behind it. And they have more coming in the pipeline that are, I think, certain to be bestsellers, including, I think, most significantly, another book by Bob Woodward. His previous book about the Trump administration, which was titled Fear, sold millions of copies and, again, caused a lot of consternation in the administration. And he has a sequel to that that's coming out this fall. I don't believe it's titled yet, but it's about the administration. President has said he spoke to Bob Woodward for this book. So it'll be interesting to see what, you know, what secrets remain for Bob Woodward to find out, given all of these tell-alls that have come out. I was speaking to some people in Washington, like Robert Barnett, who is a famous Washington lawyer who represents a lot of politicians and has been around for a long time. And his observation I thought was interesting. It's just, you know, the volume of books that have been that have come out during this administration is quite unusual. It's fairly typical for there to be a wave of memoirs, tell-alls, I was inside the room kind of books to come out the years after the presidency, when people can reflect and there's no longer the political pressures of the day or a re-election campaign, for example. But the revolving door in the administration today has been moving so quickly, people cycle in and out. And I think that has accelerated the rate of tell-alls.
All right. Well, I'm sure you'll be telling us all about them in future episodes of the podcast.
I'm sure there'll be more to come.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
My colleagues Tina Jordan and John Williams join us now. Hey, guys.
Hey, Pamela.
Hello.
I feel like it's been a while since we've gathered remotely together.
I do, too.
Yeah, it feels like that to me, too.
I actually have a backlog now of three books that I've read. So I'm going to talk about books that I've read a while ago, and maybe you guys could make it more contemporary by talking about what you're reading right now. But let's start with you, Tina.
So I'm reading a book called The Summer Book by Tove Jansson, who I think most people know better as a children's book author. I know, Pamela, we were talking right before we started recording about how in your house, the Moomin collected stories are a much battered and much loved book. But she did write some books for adults. And I don't know why I'd never picked this one up before. It's about a six-year-old girl and her elderly grandmother who are spending a summer on this very isolated island in the Gulf of Finland. And I swear to you, it's one of those books where nothing really seems to happen. I mean, the grandmother loses her false teeth. The two of them go off to listen to long-tailed ducks. A horrible little friend named Bernice comes to visit. But there's sort of this dark current underneath, which you understand gradually, which is that the little girl's mother has died. And you hear it in bits and pieces, mostly through her conversations with her grandmother, who I must add is not quite a storybook grandmother. She likes to nip at her cognac neat, and she smokes, and her pockets are filled with cigarettes and anxiety pills. But she's also clearly understanding the unspoken grief that her granddaughter is going through, and they're just spending hours in these very slim, short chapters making crafts. They're looking for seashells. They're listening for owls. And you really get this sense that here's the grandmother, clearly, you know, I'd say late 80s. I don't, if her age is mentioned, I haven't gotten to that yet. She's sort of slipping out of this world, and here's her feisty, impetuous, imaginative little granddaughter who's sort of finding her place in the world, but while she's coping with the death of her mother. And I just wanted to read you a really short passage of what I'm talking about when I say the grandmother's just sort of being endlessly patient with her and helping her. This is right at the beginning, I think maybe the fourth or fifth chapter. Sophia asked her grandmother what heaven looked like, and grandmother said it might be like the pasture they were just then walking by on their way to the bridge. They stopped to look. It was very hot. The road was white and cracked, and all the plants along the ditch had dust on their leaves. They walked into the pasture and sat down in the grass, which was tall and not a bit dusty. It was full of bluebells and cat's foot and buttercups. "Are there ants in heaven?" Sophia asked. "No," said grandmother, and she lay down. So it's just their conversations wax and wane. I don't know. I'm about halfway through. It's a very slender book. It's basically novella length, but I'm just loving it. And it's making me, you know, try to imagine life on this isolated island.
Tina, isn't life already like that right now for you?
Yeah, but this seems so idyllic, you know.
It's in Scandinavia.
It's in Scandinavia, right? So They're eating really good food and the forest is beautiful and they're picking berries. I don't know. It seems better than my house right now.
And it's by choice.
By choice, yeah.
John, what about you?
Tina, it's funny that you are reading that because I was going to say about the book that I finished recently that it features an elderly protagonist. And I can't think of a lot of novels that I've read that feature an elderly protagonist, like both of the books we're reading. This is a book called The Stone Angel by Margaret Lawrence, who's a writer who I've talked about on the podcast before, not too long ago. She wrote a novel called The Jest of God, which quickly became sort of a favorite novel of mine that I read earlier this year. This is a longer novel published in 1964. I think it's also one that she is even more well-known for. It's about a 91-year-old woman named Hagar Shipley, who lives with her son and her daughter-in-law in her house. And the book toggles between the current day when Marvin, the son, and Doris, the daughter-in-law, are trying to convince Hagar to move out of the house into an assisted living facility. And she will not hear any of this. She says this is, you know, it's her house. She bought it with her money. And she's not going to leave. And so half of it is her reading their signals, trying to figure out if she's really not making as much sense as they say she is. She doesn't feel like she's losing it as much as they say she is. And half of it is her going back into the past, into her memories, thinking about her marriages, her boys when they were younger, a son who she lost. And it is obviously very autumnal and sad, as that makes it sound. It's also very funny. She's very stubborn. She's cantankerous. Her inner dialogue is great. I'm going to read a little bit because I read some books on the podcast that I think would not benefit from reading passages because you sort of have to take in the whole thing. But I feel like Lawrence's prose really speaks well for itself and gives you a sense of what it is and whether you like it or not. And so I'm going to read a medium-sized paragraph from near the very beginning of the book. This is when Hagar has begun thinking about the past, and she starts with a sentence that I love. She says, "Now I am rampant with memory. I don't often indulge in this, or not so very often anyway. Some people will tell you that the old live in the past. That's nonsense. Each day, so worthless really, has a rarity for me lately. I could put it in a vase and admire it, like the first dandelions, and we would forget their weediness and marvel that they were there at all. But one dissembles, usually, for the sake of such people as Marvin, who is somehow comforted by the picture of old ladies feeding like docile rabbits on the lettuce leaves of other times, other manners. How unfair I am. Well, why not? To carp like this, it's my only enjoyment. That and the cigarettes, a habit I acquired only 10 years ago out of boredom. Marvin thinks it's disgraceful of me to smoke at my age, 90. To him, there is something distressing in the sight of Hagar Shipley, who by some mischance happens to be his mother, with a little white burning tube held saucily between arthritic fingers. Now I light one of my cigarettes and stump around my room, remembering furiously, for no reason except that I am caught up in it. I must be careful not to speak aloud, though, for if I do, Marvin will look at Doris, and Doris will look meaningfully back at Marvin, and one of them will say, 'Mother's having one of her days.' Let them talk. What do I care now what people say? I cared too long."
Ooh.
So that's the narrator of The Stone Angel by Margaret Lawrence, which I greatly enjoyed. And now I'm doing something which I don't normally do, which is I have about 4 or 5 books that I've read the first several pages of, and I'm kind of waiting to see which one takes for the next time we meet.
John, might I say, if you're ever looking for a diversion, you might like this very slim Scandinavian murder mystery. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I will when you say it, because I think you've discussed it before.
An elderly woman is up to no good. Yes. It's about a homicidal octogenarian. It's one
and
of
the book you're talking about this week is something I've heard a lot about.
Yeah.
And
would, anyway.
Be interested in
all right.
So Pamela, how old is the person in the book you're reading?
Well, one of them is not a person. So I read 2 books that I'm going to talk about, both of which I really enjoyed, but both of which for different reasons were very disconcerting and upsetting in their reading experiences. So the first book I read was Kate DiCamillo's The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane, and that does not feature a human, but a toy rabbit, a stuffed rabbit with a porcelain head. And this is a book that the novelist Ann Patchett had waxed rhapsodic about in our pages, and my kid book club chose it for their book. And I was very excited because Kate DiCamillo is one of those writers who I always hoped that my kids would read, but they never do. And I guess here's where, you know, the sort of upsetting and disconcerting part comes into play, which is that for some reason, I always want my kids to like animal stories, and they very rarely do. Like, unless they are the murderous rabbits of the Warrior series by Aaron Hunter, they're not interested really in touching animal tales, you know, like Black Beauty. You know, they don't care for that sort of thing. And I hope to convert my youngest child to The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane by reading it aloud to him. So I, you know, this is like quarantine activity. I thought, I'll get this book, I'll kill two birds with one stone. I'll read it for my club by reading it aloud to my youngest child at night. And he was just bored out of his skull. I was enchanted, I have to say, but he really didn't care for it. And after a while, he just said, could you just stop? Just read it to yourself. So, you know, there's this sort of like brutal irony that like I ended up reading this kid's book by myself and he never ended up reading it. But it's a lost stuffed animal story. And I'm a fan of those. I, you know, love the Knuffle Bunny stories, the Mo Willems, which culminate the trilogy with Knuffle Bunny Free, which is the child sort of giving up her lovey for good as she gets older. This book, The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane, reminded me most of one of my favorite picture books, which is Tomi Ungerer's Otto, the autobiography of a teddy bear. And if you have not read this book, I highly recommend it, but only if you like to cry. It never fails to get me to cry because it's a Holocaust story, like for kids. It's not really for kids, but it's about a stuffed teddy bear that gets lost during World War II and the Holocaust. And anyway, it ends with a very tear-stained reunion. And Edward Tulane sort of follows a similar path. And if you've read Otto, you know where Edward Tulane, who's a stuffed rabbit who gets lost when he is accidentally flung overboard a ship crossing from the United States to Europe, you know where it's going to go. So that was that book. I enjoyed it. My son did not.
Can we pause there for a second? You have three kids and you said none of them like these touching animal stories. I mean, is this a generational thing? Because we grew up with them as such a, you know, Black Beauty and many others.
I think, John, what it is that if a parent has loved a book as a child, like the child is automatically predisposed to like, I don't know. My kids, I don't know if they were making it up or not. I don't think so. Professed to detest everything I had loved as a kid.
Right, it was
heartbreaking.
I think that your kids, Tina, are like mine and that there's a strong contrarian streak going on. And two of my kids really don't like sad books, which just is like a very sharp divide between our tastes, my tastes and theirs, which brings me to the other book I read, which was Henry James's The American. So I was really in the mood for Henry James or Thomas Hardy. Again, the sadness. And part of my quarantine restriction for myself is really to just read what I've got. I've failed so far, so just don't get any illusions that I'm succeeding in this, but I'm trying to read out of my current inventory. So I don't have any Hardy that I haven't read. And I was looking for Henry James, and I was hoping to finally read The Wings of the Dove, which I'd never read, or The Ambassadors. But all I could find after an extended search in the basement was a copy of The American. And I thought, aha, an early James that I've never read. And so I read it and I didn't get into it right away. It's the story of Christopher Newman, who's like a typical self-made American millionaire, rags to riches story, goes over to France on not really a tour, but a kind of early retirement. And he's going to finally get to laze about and do all the things he didn't do while he was working hard in finance to make money. And he falls in love with an aristocratic French woman named Claire de Bellegarde. So we really have these like very obvious kind of Dickensian names, you know. And the theme of like the new American man who can establish himself, you know, by his own wit and grit, as opposed to the French aristocrat who is who she is by dint of where she came from and her descendants. That argument to me felt like so stale as and so irrelevant as to be dull. And it's funny because I feel like even in the 90s, when I lived in France for the first time, or the 80s, actually, like that was still a little bit of a thing, like a tiny remnant in the culture. But right now, it's hard to think of like anyone, frankly, who cares or thinks that's at all an argument of like, you know, the new American versus the old European. But I
while the theme sort of left me flat, I managed to get caught up in the plot after a while. You know, will they get married? Will her, you know, evil family succeed in destroying the match? And I read it very quickly at the end and finished it and thought, okay, finally, I at least know what happened, even if this didn't 100% grip me. A week or so after I finished the book, I was going through my book of books, which is this, you know, journal I've been keeping of the books that I've read, and going through it for another reason, for a project that Tina and I were actually working on. And to my horror, I found marked very clearly in the year 2004, The American. And I cannot even say, I mean, this has happened before. I think The Mill and the Floss was sort of the most obvious instance. I've done this with movies where I've like seen maybe three quarters of a movie before realizing I'd seen it before. I don't know that I've ever read an entire book having absolutely no idea that I'd already read it. I mean, from beginning to end, you would think at some point it would have become familiar. And yet, no, I never once realized I didn't recognize a single thing. I was desperate to know how it ended, even though I knew it would not end well. And so it's really kind of, I'm still horror struck by the whole thing. I'm a little bit, I'm ashamed to even be admitting it on this podcast, but I sort of have this, you know, urge to take the most shameful things and fling them out into the open. So there you have it. I'm curious if either of you have ever...
I think that's going to happen for sure, because
when you get bolted in your dotage, like
No. I think we're very similar in age. It's just that I don't really, other than the things I really love the most, I often barely remember any details of a book. And so even like a book like The American, I think I read that maybe 10, 12 years ago or something. And I remember enjoying it, but I have almost no idea. I couldn't tell you anything about it, really. A couple of drawing room scenes come to mind, but nothing super specific. So I think the only thing that keeps me from doing that is that I hold on to so many of my books and I at least mark a little bit inside them. So I think what will happen is I'll start reading something and then 40 pages in, see a marking and think, wait, who did this? Was that me?
You know, in my defense, I was very pregnant at the time, and I had the kind of pregnancies that like really weighed down on my brain. I know that I went to see a lot of theater when I was during all three pregnancies, and if I didn't walk out, I fell asleep. I don't really think it's a persuasive or in full excuse for what occurred here.
Well, you read a lot, and I don't know. I'm not trying to let you off the hook too easily, but I do think that this is something I'm fearing for myself just because of my forgetfulness.
Tina,
what about you?
Oh no, I'm sure I've done this. I mean, I'm like you. We all read so much. It's only the stuff I either absolutely love or detest that sort of stays imprinted on my brain.
Okay, you guys have made me feel a little bit better. I haven't entirely, I'm sweating here, just to make it clear.
I think all three of us are ready to read this 91-year-old narrator that I talked about this week.
All right, yes, let's all read about older people in Scandinavia or other cool parts. Tina, John, let's run down the titles of the books again.
I'm reading The Summer Book by Tove Jansson.
I've read The Stone Angel by Margaret Lawrence, and that's Laurence.
And I read Kate DiCamillo's The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane and Henry James's The American. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.